Okay, we've seen already when Cyrus permitted the captives in Babylon to return to Jerusalem. We are told in chapter 2 and verse 1, before he began to give the names of the people who return, or at least the heads of the families of the people who return, we were told that when they returned to Jerusalem, they went each to his own town. Now, of course, many of these people would have been born in captivity. And so that just simply means that they went to the town in which they lived, if they were old enough to have been living before the captivity. Or in the case of others, they would have gone to the towns where their relatives lived. And then we learn in chapter 3 that in the seventh month, they were all in these towns, having gone there. And then on the first day of the seventh month, they came together in Jerusalem as one man. And altar having been built, and we've talked about the importance of the seventh month, how that it was the most sacred month in the calendar of the Jewish people, and they wanted to begin using this altar, begin again, reestablish the sacrifices that were required by the old law. And we talked quite a bit in detail about that. And then in the latter part of chapter 3, we learn that in the second month of the second year, that is the second year after they got there, in the second month, they began to build the temple. Having made arrangements before that, they gathered together masons and carpenters and made arrangements with Tyre and Sidon to have timber delivered to them. And so they began to build the temple. And from what is said there and from what is said afterward, we learn that basically all they got done was the foundation. But as the people saw the foundation being laid, the priests adorned themselves in their priestly apparel, and they celebrated that very important event. Now, and then we came to chapter 4. We looked at this last week in the first part of chapter 4, their adversaries. This is a reference to those Samaritans, they will later be called, or as what we refer to them. But here they're simply called the adversaries. This was a mixed race of people, a mixture of, first of all, the remnant of the Israelites who had been left in that area following the destruction of their kingdom, and then some 9 to 12 other peoples from other nations had been brought in over a period of time. I think I told you last week that the indication is there were at least 3 colonizations where they brought people in from other places and put them in Samaria, where many of the people had been killed and many had been taken away into captivity. And it was such a few people that actually the wild animals began to become a problem. And the people, well, we won't go through all that again. But anyway, they brought in a priest to teach the people about the God of that area. And of course, you remember, this priest wouldn't be much help in terms of true religion, because the northern kingdom had been destroyed because they had rebelled against God. They had worshipped idols and so forth. And so this priest would have taught what they had done before they were destroyed. But anyway, these are the enemies, and they came saying, "Let us help you build." And probably they had ulterior motives, but wisely they were not permitted to do that. They said, "You have nothing to do with us," verse 3 of chapter 4, "in building the house of God, but we alone will build to the Lord the house of God." And then in verse 4, "The people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build." and bribed counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, after he had issued this edict and permitted them to return, Cyrus, if you followed history, he was still busy conquering in wars and such like. And so it was not easy, but they were able to disrupt the work, partly because he was not able to give his full attention to it. In all the days of the king of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And in verse 24, the last verse of this chapter, we learn that it's until the second year of Darius. So in all, that was, I think I told you last week, that's about 14 years. There was about 5 years remaining on Cyrus's reign. And then there was 7.5 years involved in the reign of Cambyses, his son, who, by the way, was not a friend of the Jews like his father was. And then there was about 7 to 10 months, or in any case, a little less than a year, of the reign of a person referred to as Pseudo-Smerdis. Smerdis had usurped the throne. He pretended to be the brother of Cambyses, who really had been murdered. And so finally the people got wise to him, and we'll make reference to that in a minute. So that's what had been going on. And so it appears that they started building, they laid the foundation, and then all this trouble began. And I don't get the impression that they were able to do much work on it from that time. It seems like they, to use an expression we would use in the country, they would give it a hit and a lick every now and then, but not a lot of progress was made on the temple. Now, we come to, and I said too much last week or the week before, got too much in the weeds in this. I'm not going to do it this morning, but I want to look to, with you beginning at verse 6. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. You remember I said to you that commentators are divided on the rest of this chapter. Some think there's only one letter talked about. Some think there were two. Some think there were three. And then some think that verses 6 through 23 really tell of a time that happened far in the future. I can't buy that, I can't. Maybe you can, but the idea, even our brother Kaufman subscribes to that in his commentary. The idea being that the writer wants us to see that this opposition on the part of these adversaries lasted for nearly 100 years. And to do that, he reaches forward into the future, at least in terms of the history that he's reporting right here. And he inserts here something that happened way down the road. Okay, that's as much as I want to say about that. But most of the commentators believe, and I'm going to just talk this morning as though there are two letters. I tend to think that verse 6 describes a letter we're not given the letter, but we're just simply told that a letter was written. An accusation against the people was written, and this was done during the reign of Ahasuerus. This is thought by many commentators, most commentators, in fact, to be the Cambyses, the son of Cyrus. Okay? Then, so let's look at verses 7 through 9. And in the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam, and Mithridath and Tabeel and the rest of their associates wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the letter was written in Aramaic and translated. Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, the scribe, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes, the king, as follows. Rehum, the commander, Shimshai, the scribe, the rest of their associates, the judges, the governors, the officials, the Persians, the men of Erech, the Babylonians, the men of Susa. See, this is some of the places from which these people had been brought into this area. I don't know, there's six or eight named here. The men of Susa, that is the Elamites, and the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Osnapper deported and settled in the cities of Samaria and the rest of the province beyond the river. We have no idea who Osnapper was. Some think that he was Esarhaddon, that it was mentioned up in, what, verse 3. Others think that he probably was, and I tend to think this is more likely, he was may have been one of his officers who was had the responsibility of taking people from this place and moving them to this place, you know, and so forth. So, now, I just want to say this, don't want to get, but I'm of the opinion that verses 7, 8, and 9 are all talking about the same letter. I think I mentioned this briefly the other day. I think verse 7, where it talks about Bishlam and Mithridath and Tabeel, these were the contrivers. These were the plotters. And I'm of the opinion that they wrote a letter in the sense that they had a letter written. They caused a letter to be written, or maybe they began actually writing a letter, and then they took it. Then the next verse, Rehum the commander and Shimshai the scribe, these are more official people. This is likely one of the governors of the province that had responsibility for them, and so they somehow or another cajoled him to become involved, and he either actually wrote the letter or looked at the one that they had, you know, and put it in better order or something of that nature. And then verse 9, Rehum, the commandant, and the rest of the associates, these are the people who subscribed to the letter. In other words, all of these were co-signers. You know, we concur with what is said in this letter. All of that done to sway the king of Persia. Now let's keep reading. In verse 11, this is a copy of the letter that they sent to Artaxerxes the king, your servants, the men of the province beyond the river, send greeting. Now this expression beyond the river, usually when we read that in the Old Testament, we're thinking about the River Jordan, and it has reference to the land of Israel. But here, likely, it has reference to, remember now, it has reference from the perspective of the Persians, beyond the river likely is a reference to the Euphrates River. And the reference is to all of that land west of the Euphrates, which was under their governance and so forth. And so, be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from you to us have gone to Jerusalem. They are rebuilding that rebellious city, wicked city, and they are finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. This is one of the verses that's used by those who believe that this actually is describing something that happened years later. They say because they were not, this doesn't talk about the building of the temple. I think they're wrong. I think you'll see in verse 24 that it is. But this talking about the building of the walls and so forth, and that had not yet begun. Well, I think this is just a hyperbole. I think these are people who are just describing, all they saw was work going on in Jerusalem. And in some instances, it might have appeared that they were rebuilding the city because some of the people would be rebuilding the houses to live in there. And we talked about how many of those houses were built along the wall. And so it would look like in places that the wall, but there's nothing here that really causes any concern about the idea that we're presenting here this morning. Now, be it known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls finished, they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll, and the royal revenue will be impaired. Now, because we eat the salt of the palace, that's an expression some, no doubt, who were involved in sending this letter were actually on the payroll. They were employees, as it were. But in another sense, all of the province benefited from the Persian government. And so to eat the salt means if you get your sustenance from someone, that's as if you're eating the salt of that person, and you're obligated to look after their interests. Yes. Absolutely. I think you're exactly right. I think that's exactly what they're doing. Trying to make it worse than it actually is, even, so that they can get the results. Okay. Now, in order that, look at verse 15. In order that search may be made in the book of the records of your fathers, you will find in the book of the records and learn that this city is a rebellious city, hurtful to kings and provinces, and that sedition was stirred up in it from of old. That is why this city was laid waste. This is likely a reference to the last three kings. You remember? Jehoiakim, his son Jehoiachin, and then Zedekiah, the very last king. All three of those did, in fact, rebel against Babylon. And so there was general knowledge of this. So that much of the letter is true. We make it known. Oh, by the way, search may be made in the book of records. We know from a number of sources that these records did exist. But you remember the book of Esther? And you remember the story of Mordecai and how that one day he observed that two of the eunuchs who were personal guards to the king were plotting to do him harm, take his life. And Mordecai uncovered this, made it known through Esther what was going to happen. And so he was rewarded for that. And the record of that was written in the daily record, okay? So one night later on, what happened? The king was not able to sleep. And he said, bring the record and read to me. And they brought it. And they were reading, and he was reminded from the reading of what Mordecai had done, and he asked, what did we ever do for him? Was he properly honored, and was proper appreciation shown? And of course, if we have time, we're going to get to Esther. But you remember, Haman had already started his work, and he hated Mordecai because he wouldn't bow down to him. And so he was already planning to get rid of Mordecai. And he was puffed up and thought the king and the queen thought he was great. And she invited him into this banquet. And after that night of unrest, when he read about this, the king, when Haman came in that morning, said, what should be done to the one whom the king wants to honor? And Haman thought, well, who could that be but me? And so he laid it on thick. He told him what all he ought to do. And the king said, you know, that's good. That's exactly what we'll do. So be it done to Mordecai. And I want you to do it. So he had to go out the king's robe was put on Haman, on Mordecai, and he was mounted on his horse, and he was led through all of that. But that's an example of the record. So there did exist. I got off again. The king said, we make known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls finished, you will then have no possession in the province beyond the river. The king sent an answer to Rehum the commander and Shimshai the scribe and the rest of their associates who live in Samaria and in the rest of the province beyond the river, greeting. And now, the letter that you sent to us has been plainly read before me, and I made a decree, and search has been made, and it has been found that this city from of old has risen against kings and that rebellion and sedition have been made in it, and mighty kings have been over Jerusalem. This is no doubt a reference to David and Solomon, the days of the glory of those kings, who ruled over the whole province beyond the river, to whom tribute, custom, and toll were paid. Both David and Solomon, they reigned over all the territory right up to the river Euphrates. That's how large their kingdom was at one time. And so, therefore, I make a decree that these men be made to cease, and that this city be not rebuilt until a decree is made by me, and take care not to slack in this matter. Why should damage grow to the hurt of the king? Now note verse 23. Then when the copy of the king of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai, the scribe, and their associates, they went in haste to the Jews at Jerusalem, and by force and power made them cease. And notice this last verse, verse 24. Then the work on the house of God that is in Jerusalem stopped. What does it say? Does it say the building of the wall stopped? No. It says the work on the house of God that is in Jerusalem stopped, and it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius. And so whenever this letter was received, and how long it was after they had begun laying the foundations, but had been interrupted, even before this letter, I get the idea that there were continual interruptions and that they never were able to just work uninhibited, you know. But at this point, it was what? It was brought to a stop. It was brought to a stop. Now we come to chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Now the prophets, now remember, the work has stopped now, completely stopped. Now the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, he was actually the son of Berechiah, as we'll learn when we look at the book of Zechariah itself. He was the grandson of Iddo, and that's what that word means. It can mean either son or grandson or relative. So now the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, I've completely lost the pronunciation of the word, Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Josedech, arose and began to rebuild the house of God that is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. So, on the first day of the sixth month of the second year of Darius' reign as king, Haggai began his ministry. Now, and through his words that he delivered, which were from God, he stirred up not only Zerubbabel and Joshua, but also the people, to the point that they began to work on the temple. Just slightly more than 3 weeks after his prophecy. By the way, now the word prophecy, let's remember, prophets were God's what? Spokesmen. And they were not always foretelling. Sometime, in fact, most of the time, they were what? Forthtelling. In other words, any teaching of a prophet is referred to as prophecy. Sometimes he's foretelling the future, at other times he's merely talking to them about present times and things they need to know. So So, lost my thought. he stirs up the people, and we'll see in a minute when we turn to that book what he said and how he stirred them up. So this was the first day of the sixth month that he began to prophesy. 24 days later, they actually began the work. Boy, they didn't take them. They had to make some preparation, but they didn't delay much this time. Lest I forget it, this is an example of the power of good preaching and teaching. Think about it. Here these people had been indolent, had been indifferent, had been, as we're going to see, involved in all other kinds of things except building the temple. And this prophet, now Haggai seems to have been near the end of his life. We believe, for example, from a verse that we're going to read in a minute, we think that he was probably one of those who laid the foundation in tears, you remember? And so there's every indication that he was, when he was brought into captivity, he was alive when he was brought into captivity and had seen perhaps the old temple. He was an older person when he was called to the ministry of prophecy. And his ministry lasted, at least as far as what we know, 4 months. His first prophecy was uttered on the first day of the sixth month, and his last two words of prophecy were uttered on the 24th day of the ninth month. And so a relatively short period of time. And yet, look what he did. When he faithfully proclaimed the word of God in apparently a powerful and persuasive way, these people got ready to begin again. Now, 2 months after he began his ministry, Zechariah began his ministry. And unlike Haggai, he seems to have been, there's reason to believe that he was a young man when he was called to ministry. Perhaps even born. Either not long before the exiles returned, or perhaps, you see, it had been 16 years. But anyway, he was a young man, and I won't speculate on how old he was, but he was a young man when he was, when he was called a minister, and we'll look at him a little bit later as well. Think about it. For a long time, the people had been frustrated in their work. They had laid the foundation of the temple. They were eager, enthusiastic in the beginning, and then all this trouble started. They were constantly harassed. All kinds of things. We even speculated on what some of those things might have been. Interruption of the supply line, the money that the king had promised to pay for all of this. No doubt different things had been said to the governor of the province who would actually provide that money, and that had no doubt at times been interrupted so many things had, and they were just discouraged. But not only were they discouraged, they had begun to think more about other things than about building the temple. And Haggai is going to talk to us about that. But instead of watching eagerly, awaiting the first opportunity that might present itself to get back to work, they were seemingly more concerned about their own personal comfort and so forth. Haggai will talk to them about, you've got time to panel your houses while the temple lies waste. How can you explain that? And just before Darius began to reign, there had been a revolution. You remember this Smyrdis that we talked about? And many commentators believe that even though his was a short reign, many commentators believe that it was during the reign of this Smyrdis that this letter was written. But a revolution broke out when they began to figure this guy all out. and he was dethroned and put to death. And then Darius became king. And so they had fallen into such indifference that they failed even to see that as an opportunity. Here was this guy who had said to them, "No, you can't build anymore, stop," was now gone. He was off the scene, and there was a new fella, and no attempt had been made apparently for a whole year, because remember, it's in the second year of Darius. Well, more than that, because it was the 6th month of the second year. So almost a year and a half, well, it was a year and a half, that nothing had been done. And it seems like that even Zerubbabel and Joshua, or Jeshua the priest, had been caught up in this as well. And then into such a situation, on the scene came this prophet. This prophet of God. And he stirs up the people. He talks to them about, as I said before, he talks to them about, well, you've got time for this, you got time for that, and we're going to read this in just a minute, but you don't have time to build the house of God. Now, remember, there were 3 prophets following the return of the exiles. Haggai, he was the oldest in age, and also the first of those 3 to prophesy, although just 2 months earlier than Zechariah, who seemingly was a young person, and he prophesied for some years for 4 years until the temple was actually rebuilt, and then no doubt beyond that. And then there was Malachi. And so from the time Haggai coming on the scene to Malachi finishing his was about 100 years. In about 100 years from the time that Haggai first prophesied, the last prophet of the Old Testament finished his prophecy. And then there was a period of time of some 420 or so years during which there was no prophecy. None until John the Baptist came on the scene. One other thing, look at verse 2. It says that Zerubbabel and Jeshua began to rebuild the house of God that is in Jerusalem. The prophets of God were with them, helping them. And there are 3 or 4 ways in which they no doubt helped them. First of all, they helped them by direct command. An example of that is Haggai chapter 1 and verse 8. Haggai said to them, "Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house." And we're going to talk about that verse in just a minute. But that's an example of the commands that they gave them. And then they were also supported by warnings. An example of which is Haggai chapter 1 and verse 9. "Because mine house that is waste, therefore, because that my house lies in waste, therefore the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit." In other words, they were in the midst of a drought that we're going to talk about, and this was as a warning. Unless you get busy and start building this, that's the sort of thing you can expect. Then they were supported by exhortations. Haggai said in chapter 2 and verse 4, "Be strong, O Zerubbabel," said the Lord. "Be strong, O Joshua, son of Josedek, the high priest, and be ye strong, all the people of the land," said the Lord, "and work." And then finally, they were helped by encouraging prophecy. In Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 9, "The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of his house, and his hands shall also finish it." And then in chapter 2 and verse 9 of Haggai said, "The glory of this latter house shall be greater than the former, said the Lord of hosts. And in this place I will give peace to the people." And so these are just some of the ways that they encourage the work there. Any question or comment before we move? Turn now to the book of Haggai. We won't have time to discuss in depth this, but I just want to read a little bit. Since we read from Ezra that these two prophets got involved at this point and encouraged them and stirred them up to begin the work again. In chapter 1 of verse 1 of Haggai, in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, on the first day of the month, the new moon day, the word of the Lord came by the hand of Haggai the prophet to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and governor of Judah, and Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, these people say the time has not yet come to rebuild the house of the Lord. This is what they were saying. I don't know how they had, they were trying to find a way to justify their inactivity. I don't know exactly what they meant by this. Some think that some were saying, well, the 70 years, they were thinking of 70 years from the time of the last carrying away. And not quite 70 years would have elapsed from that time. And so some think that may have been what they were talking about. Or it may have been a reference to the continued resistance of their adversaries in the area. And so they might have said, well, these people, this is just not the time, and God must know that this is not the time yet. Whatever it was, they were saying to themselves, the time has not yet come. Then the word of the Lord came by the hand of Haggai the prophet and said, is it a time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses while this house lies in ruin? You say the time has not come for us to rebuild the temple, but you seem to have the means, the stamina, and the inclination to do all this stuff, make it more comfortable to live in your houses and in other ways as well. Now, therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. You have sown much and harvested little. You eat, but you never have enough. You drink, but you never have your fill. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And he who earns wages does so to put them in a bag with holes. Now, it seems to me that he's talking about a time of drought or something so that the crops were not really good. It's not that they didn't have any crops, but as we'll see later on, when they would pick grapes and put them in the vat, they just weren't good. Perhaps you've gone out occasionally we go out to pick figs, and some years the figs are better than they are other years. Some years the grapes are better than they are, have more juice and such like. And some people think that this is not so much a reference to an actual drought, but more to a spiritual problem that they had. I think it's okay to think about both. It may be that they had that this concern about their own well-being had become so strong and had supplanted their desire to do the will of God that they were actually had gotten to the point where they weren't content with whatever they had. Paul said, godly contentment is what? Great gain. I've learned to be content in whatever state I'm in. And maybe the more they had, the what? The more they wanted. I don't know, but it seems to be both, as we'll see from some of the other. Verse 7, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the hills and bring wood and build the house that I may take pleasure in it and that I may be glorified. Was he telling them to go to Phoenicia, to Tyre and Sidon, to get timber? Not likely, but it raises the question, what had happened to the timber that they had made arrangements for several years ago before they started laying the foundation to begin with? Had they taken it? Was that what they had been using to panel their houses with? I don't know. But it may have just been an exhortation to go to the hills nearby. We'll learn in the book of Nehemiah that the king's forest, what is referred to as the king's forest, was not too far away. And so it may have been a reference to that. But for whatever it meant, he's simply saying, go into the hills, get busy, go get wood to build the house that I may take pleasure in it and that I may be glorified, says the Lord. You look for much, and behold, it came to little. And you brought it home, and I blew it away. Why? Why? Why has there been this drought? Have you thought about that? Why, declares the Lord of hosts? Because of my house that lies in ruins, while each of you busy yourselves with your own house. In other words, you should think. And if you thought as you should, you would realize that what has happened, what you've experienced, is the Lord's way of telling you, you need to get back to what's important. And I have called for a drought on the land and the hills, on the grain, the new wine, the oil, on what the ground brings forth, on man and beast, and on their labors. Now here it is in verse 12. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the words of Haggai the prophet, as the Lord their God had sent him. And the people feared the Lord. I want to say again, as we close this morning, an example of the power of the taught and preached Word of God. And the most important thing we can do is to make sure as a congregation that our people are being taught, are being fed spiritually, and there's so much to lead us in an opposite direction. We want to talk about this, we want to talk about that, we want to talk about the latest trend, we want to talk about the latest book or whatever. But the book and the message of the book is the thing that needs to be taught. Any questions or comments before we... David? That's right. That's exactly right. Well, we're going to spend a little bit more time next week in Zechariah and a little bit of time in Haggai and a little bit of time in Zechariah. There are 13 chapters in Zechariah. But we'll talk a little bit about them and see the work of these two prophets and how that in the first place they encourage the people to get back to the work of rebuilding. And then we'll get back to Ezra and finish it. And then we'll head into Nehemiah. Any questions or comments? All right. Thank you.